Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review about legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. I'm your host, Drew Padley, editor-in-chief of the Houston Law Review. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 13 offices and more than 750 lawyers committed to excellence in serving its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's summer associate program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins. Today on the show, we have Professor George Contreras from the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. Professor Contreras teaches in the areas of intellectual property law, and genetics in the law. Prior to the University of Utah, he served on the faculty at American University and Wash U in St. Louis and was a partner at the law firm Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr. Finally, as of this month, Professor Contreras has also added Houston Law Review author to his distinguished resume. His article, Pledging Patents for the Public Good, Rise and Fall of the Eco-Patent Commons, is co-authored with economics professors Bronwyn Hall of UC Berkeley and Christian Helmers of Santa Clara University. You can find this article in Volume 57, Issue 1, page 61. All right, now with that long introduction, Professor Contreras, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, sure. I was surprised to see that you were in town, and I'm happy that you were able to make the time to come talk to us about your article.
I get to Houston as often as I can. As I was a Rice University alum, I get back to town a couple times a year.
That's great. So before we dive into your article, can you tell me a little bit about your background? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a variety of places, but from about the age of 13, I lived outside of Dallas in a town called Irving, where I went to high school, and then came here to Houston for college, and left for law school, went to law school in Boston, but came back for a year to Austin, where I clerked for the Texas Supreme Court, but then went back east for a number of years, where I practiced law in a large East Coast firm, and finally ended up as an academic, and I'm now at the University of Utah, where I teach.
All right. What exactly got you interested in the law? Is it something that you always knew you wanted to do as a career, or were you sort of driven to it later in life?
It certainly wasn't always part of my plan. It came about a little bit serendipitously. I was an electrical engineering major at Rice and was proceeding along that path for a while until one summer I had a summer job at the then famous AT&T Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, where I kind of by accident was put in the patent department. And I enjoyed that summer so much that when I got back to Rice in the fall of my junior year, I decided law school was probably the thing I wanted to do. And I picked up an English double major since I figured I should, you know, learn how to write a bit more. And the rest is history. I took the LSAT, applied for law school, and ended up doing it.
Wonderful. And so after all those years at a big firm, what was it that made you decide to make the switch to becoming a law professor?
Oh, well, it's a well-kept but also well-known secret that being a law professor is really one of the best jobs in the world. I practiced law for 17 years, and I was quite happy with it for a number of those years. But, you know, there's something about the freedom to write about and think about whatever issues you feel like thinking about that is quite liberating and is very different than a law firm environment where the issues you think about are the ones that your client is willing to pay you to think about. So I'd certainly recommend a law firm to anyone who's interested for a while, but for true freedom of thought and allowing your work to take you where it will, there's nothing like being an academic.
All right. I think that's a great advertisement for being a law professor.
There you go.
Now that we know a little bit more about you, let's talk about your article. So I mentioned the article in our introduction. Again, the title of this article is Pledging Patents for the Public Good, Rise and Fall of the Eco-Patent Commons. And before we get started, I have a little bit of a disclaimer for our listeners. So the article involves some pretty high-level econometric analysis, and Professor Contreras here has informed me that his co-authors are the authorities with respect to that. Because they're not here, we'll focus more on the eco-patent commons itself and how that played out. And at some point, maybe we'll have your co-authors on the show and they can talk about the econometrics. All right, so just let's pull all the way back and start at the most fundamental idea here. So can you just briefly describe for our listeners what a patent is and then what a patent commons is?
Sure. So a patent is a government-granted franchise over a particular technology or particular invention that lasts for 20 years from the date from when you file it, right? So if you invent something, you apply for a patent. If it is novel, inventive, meets all the criteria for patentability, the government will say that you are the only one who can make, use, or sell that invention in the United States or whatever the country is of grant for that 20-year period.
Okay, great. And so what is a patent commons?
So there is a growing literature about what companies and people do with their patents. Ordinarily, you have a patent. It gives you exclusive rights to this invention for 20 years. So you can go into business, and for 20 years, you'll be the only one producing whatever the patented article is. Say it's a drug. Drug companies follow this pattern. Usually by the time they get FDA approval, they have a lot less than 20 years. But for whatever the 12 to 14 years is that they've got, they will be the only one producing or selling the drug in the United States. And they can charge a monopoly price as a result and earn a lot of money during that period. And that's our classical model of what you do when you have a patent. But it's come to the attention of scholars over the years that there are clearly some companies who are not exerting their patent rights to the max all the time. They are willfully holding back on some of their rights. And, you know, this is a phenomenon that I've written about somewhat extensively called patent pledges. Right, I've got a patent, but I'm going to promise that I won't do something with this patent. Either maybe I won't charge those monopoly level royalties, right? Maybe I'll commit to some industry body that I'll only charge royalties that are fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, right? I limit the amount of money that I can make from this patent. Maybe I will make a pledge that says I will not sue small businesses for infringing this patent, any company with 30 employees or fewer. Maybe I'll make a pledge that says I will not transfer my patent to a non-practicing entity, right? A patent assertion entity, what is sometimes called a patent troll. All of these pledges have been made by relatively large companies. A patent commons is something like this. It's a community of companies who have gotten together all to make the same pledge with respect to their patents.
Okay, great. And so they all come together to make the same pledge, and that pledge can follow sort of any one of those formats that you described, where either they will pledge not to transfer them to a patent assertion entity, or they pledge not to enforce them, or something like that.
Right. Depending on what the rules are that they set up, this is all done, you know, through private ordering. Whatever contracts or policies the members of this commons want to put in place, they can follow. It depends on what their goals are, right? So in some cases, when a group of companies is trying to get the industry to adopt a standard, for example, for data exchange, you know, they'll want everybody to adopt the standard, and so they'll commit that they won't charge any royalties, perhaps, for these patents, or they'll charge low royalties, or one of the other things that we've talked about. As long as they've agreed on what the rules of the game are, and they're not illegal or anti-competitive in some way, they can do it.
Wonderful. And I think you mentioned a few others, and maybe you can help me understand if these are also patent commons, but like a cross-licensing agreement or a patent pool, are those considered part of Are those considered to be patent commons as well, just kind of more specific versions of it, or are they something separate entirely?
I would consider those a bit different. There's no, you know, these terms aren't in Black's Law Dictionary. Different people have different definitions for them. A cross-licensing arrangement, often between two or even more parties, it's defined by contract and allows you to do pretty much whatever you want. Generally, even if they're not charged, it's generally considered that value is exchanging hands between those companies. Patent pools often are formed around different standards, different technologies. They're efficient. They certainly help technologies to be adopted more easily. Back in the day, if you ever wanted to manufacture a DVD player, there were two patent pools to go to, and there you would get most of the patents you need to make that DVD player. But you're paying for this. Generally, when we think about common structures, money isn't involved, right? People are not exchanging money, typically.
And so what is the eco-patent commons then?
So the eco-patent commons was a group of companies who got together, 13 companies at its peak, led by IBM, to contribute to a pool as such, patents that had some environmental focus to them, either environmental protection, sustainability, climate change, reduction of waste. And there were 60 some odd categories of patents that would be eligible for contribution to this thing. And the point of it was you commit a patent to this commons or this pool. And if you do that, anybody in the world who wants to infringe it, right, create a technology or sell a product that infringes a patent, won't get sued unless they sue you. There was an exception that you could assert these patents defensively if somebody sued you first. But by and large, the idea was that you pledge these patents to the commons and then you won't assert them against anybody who's making the environmental technology that would be covered.
And I think you write that the stated mission of the Eco-Patent Commons was to manage a collection of patents pledged for unencumbered use by companies and IP rights holders around the world to make it easier and faster to innovate and implement industrial processes that improve and protect the global environment.
Couldn't have said it better.
That's right. And so it seems there's this broad goal behind the Eco-Patent Commons. It operates in this backdrop of global climate change and what seems to be more concern for the environment.
Absolutely. There are lots of very smart people thinking about what we can do to protect the environment, save it, or at least prevent further rapid degradation. These companies, certainly have been involved in that conversation.
How many corporations were involved in the Eco-Patent Commons?
At its peak, it was 13.
Okay. So we're not talking about a huge chunk of the market in any sense, but these are fairly influential and successful companies that were participating. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Obviously, 13 companies is a tiny drop in the bucket when you consider all the companies in the world. But they were large companies, IBM, Sony, Pitney Bowes, Hitachi. So some pretty big brand names.
Who administered the Eco-Patent Commons then, or who was sort of in charge of it? Was it one of these companies, IBM, or?
No, IBM was the founder. Clearly, it was IBM's vision that brought these people together. But the day-to-day administration was handled by a Geneva-based nonprofit organization called the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And basically as a favor to IBM, which was one of their members, they oversaw the commons.
And when you and your co-authors were setting out to do this analysis of the Eco-Patent Commons and to study what happened to the Eco-Patent Commons, what was your methodology for studying it?
So, maybe it's worth asking why we studied it first, before we get to our methodology, right? The, The EcoPatent Commons, when it was formed, and it was formed at the beginning of 2008, it got a lot of attention in the media and from academics who looked at this area. You know, it seemed like an effort that a lot of big companies were behind. You know, is pledging patents something that could really work to help the environment? Nobody knew at that time whether it would or not. My two co-authors, who are both economists, thought back in the late 2000s that they would do a study and try to figure out how valuable the patents were that people were contributing to the commons. Because there was, in addition to interest, there was skepticism about whether or not this was a real thing, whether these companies were just doing this as for a publicity splash, or whether they actually were planning to offer something of value to the world. If you think about companies like IBM, Nokia, Sony, you know, those aren't oil companies, right? They're not running coal plants or, you know, ships or fleets of trucks. They're not real polluters. And so you wonder, what does IBM, you know, what does Sony have to contribute to the world of green technology? Maybe these patents are just junk, you know, on the pile that no one's using, that you might as well throw into this eco patent bucket and get a little PR burst out of it. So back in 2011, my co-authors did a study to evaluate the value of the patents that were being contributed based on econometric measures that are well known in the field, citations to the patents and so forth. And back then, they found that these patents weren't particularly valuable, certainly not in terms of the overall portfolios, you know, of the patents, which makes sense. IBM is reputed to be like the world's largest patent holder. Some of their patents are incredibly valuable, but these weren't among them, right? So for example, you know, when IBM is not contributing a patent for a server farm configuration to the EcoPatent Commons, it's like a patent for cardboard boxes, you know, more efficient cardboard boxes for packaging computers. Nokia is not contributing, you know, technology for the latest data interchange at high velocity rates, right? It's contributing a patent on recycling cell phones to make them into calculators. So people wondered, and that's what they did back in 2011. I think their paper was published in 2013. And that was pretty much all that people could read. So 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, people had written about the EcoPatent Commons, and then things quieted down. It became, though, part of the accepted literature on patent pledges, on green patents. And then, purely by chance, I came across an article at one point a newspaper article that mentioned the EcoPatent Commons had disbanded in 2016. And that made me think, wow, why? What happened? This thing, you know, 8 years before had been, you know, the subject of such investigation, such interest. It just sort of fizzled out in 2016. Why did that happen? And so I tried to figure this out. And to do that, I went to Bronwyn Hall and Christian Helmers, who had done the most recent study on the commons, to see if we could together figure out what happened. And I should mention as part of this, at the time, I was a fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation, CIGI, based in Ontario, and CIGI agreed to support a research project into the rationale for the demise of the EcoPatent Commons.
Okay, great. And that's how you met the co-authors then? That's how you met Bronwyn Hall and Christian Helmers? Or did you already have a relationship with them before this?
Christian and I had collaborated on papers in the past. I'd never worked with Bronwyn Hall before, who is quite well known. I'll give her a little bit of an advertisement as one of the groundbreakers in assessing patent value based on citations.
So you team up with Bronwyn Hall and you team up with Christian Helmers, and you decide to, and then you've received funding, or at least a promise to fund this research from CIGI. And so what's the next step?
Yeah, so then we get to what methodology we decided to use. So Bronwyn and Christian extended their methodology from their earlier study, because now, doing this work in, say, 2017 and later, we have not only information about the patents before they're contributed, but we have a substantial number of years after they're contributed. So we can see what happens to the value in the citations of the patents after they've been contributed. So that's their part. And as you nicely disclaimed at the beginning, I'll leave it more or less at that. My part of this study was a more qualitative investigation and interview-based methodology, where I thought we could go find some of the people who were involved in the Eco-Patent Commons at the time it was formed, and find out why they formed it, why their companies joined, what patents they decided to put in, and then what happened over the years.
All right, let's look at that first set of interviews that you conducted. And this set, because you mentioned that you interviewed participants in the Eco-Patent Commons, and then later in the article, you write about how you interviewed inventors who cited Eco-Patent Common mm-hmm. patents after the fact. So that first set of interviews with the participants of the Eco-Patent Commons, who were these people and what did you find out?
So the people that we interviewed were the business leads at the companies who we were able to identify and then who agreed to be interviewed, but they were the business leads who were responsible for their company's participation in the Eco-Patent Commons. We also interviewed the representatives from the oversight or the organizations, right? The WBCD, and then in 2013, management shifted from the World Business Council to the Environmental Law Institute, ELI. So we interviewed someone from there as well. We found some interesting things. You know, we, even though it was only a few years later, it was still difficult to find some of these people. We weren't able to contact someone from every one of the 13 companies, but for a majority. And we got geographical dispersion as well, someone from Japan as well as Europe and the United States. So we think we got a representative sampling. It's a very small sample, but a representative sampling of the members. And most importantly, we spent a fair amount of time with IBM, which was really the leader in organizing it.
So when you discussed with these participants their role in the Eco-Patent Commons, one of the questions that you asked them is how their companies got involved with the Eco-Patent Commons in the first place and what their rationale for joining was. So what did they have to say?
So it was interesting. Some of the literature, including earlier pieces that I had written, speculated that these companies primarily joined to get benefit of a press release, a little PR boost from joining this thing.
Saving the world.
Yeah, you know, whoever was hurt by a little positive environmental green public relations, right? But I actually found that it went deeper than that. Certainly at IBM, and then the companies that IBM got to join initially, there was a fairly strong commitment within what you would call the environmental and sustainability group at the company, which often was a fairly high-level executive suite type of group. There was a commitment to do something for the environment, right? IBM would host these Davos-like conferences every year where they would bring people in to talk about the big macro issues affecting the world. And this was always an important issue. And IBM wanted to be seen as a thought leader in dealing with these issues. And so they had a whole environmental sustainability effort at IBM, as did some of these other companies. The interesting thing that we found, although not that surprising in hindsight, is that even though these efforts related to patents, it certainly was not the legal department or the patent department that initiated these activities within the companies. This all came from sort of a C-level environmental or sustainability officer at the company who then, and this probably feeds into the next question, but then told their patent group, okay, do we have any patents that we can contribute to this thing? Because we think we should join.
So it seems like the IP or the legal department was sort of had to maybe rein them in a little bit, or at least give them something that wouldn't put the company at jeopardy, certainly.
Right, because the patent department in these companies is thinking, okay, what, you want us to basically figure out what assets to give away for nothing? We paid something to get these patents to start with, so we're already giving away something, but you know, obviously, IBM isn't going to give away the architecture of its next server. We've got to find something that is not going to hurt us too much. And again, this is why it's indicative that there were no oil companies, you know, involved in this, no energy companies at all. These are all companies that are very big with big R&D departments. And in a big R&D department, if an engineer who's working on, you know, a new type of server comes up with this brilliant idea for a cardboard box, they'll patent it, right? They'll patent everything. But then the companies have on these books a cardboard box patent, and odds are they're not licensing that patent. They're not monetizing it in some way. So why not?
So is it as simple as that, just kind of looking through the patents, or did these companies use any methods that were more complicated?
Well, looking through the patents is not simple.
Okay.
A company like IBM with 100,000 patents is, you know, that's difficult. And again, we'll get to this, but I think one reason that not that many companies joined is because it is kind of a daunting exercise. You know, in some cases, one of the environmental officers knew about a patent that they shouldn't contribute because he or she was an inventor on the patent. So he said, hey, why don't we contribute my patent on this? But, you know, patent departments in these big companies are quite busy searching through the files to find something to give away for free because some corporate executive in some far-flung office said we should do it. Not always a high priority.
What about the commitment that it took to maintain involvement in the EcoPatent Commons? What did they have to say about that?
There was really very little. And this, I think, was one of the weaknesses. There, once you contributed your patents, there was really almost nothing else to do. The administrative organization kept the commons going in a very minimal way. But the companies, they got very little information. There wasn't a newsletter, maybe semi-annual conference call, but there really was very little to do after the patents were contributed.
And then how did they feel about the demise of the EcoPatent Commons?
You know, surprisingly, some of them didn't even know that it had disappeared. That it was such a low-profile entity by 2016 that nobody thought this was a bad thing. Everybody who I spoke to believed that the EcoPatent Commons had run its course and wasn't really doing a heck of a lot anymore. So nobody was particularly upset.
All right, now we move into the next category, which would be the critiques of the EcoPatent Commons. So we can start with the first one. You mentioned that there were some critiques over the membership and the recruitment of firms into the EcoPatent Commons. So what do they have to say about that?
All right, so 13 companies is not that many. There obviously are these pool type structures, pledge communities that have hundreds of members, and this is not one of them. Why not? So number one, there was no fee to join the EcoPatent Commons. And you might think that's a positive, right? That's a good thing. And it is a good thing in some ways, although you get what you pay for often. Without a fee, there's really nobody, there's not a staff person who's in charge of this thing going out there recruiting members. The World Business Council for Sustainable Development did do some work, but this, again, was really a favor to IBM and it wasn't part of their full-time remit to go out and recruit other members. So there was not an active recruitment effort, and that clearly is one of the reasons that membership never got to a critical mass. It was also not an easy sell, right? It's a complicated idea. I'm a big company. I've spent thousands of dollars getting each of these patents. You want me to give them away for, you know, why? Why should I do that? And which patents? And what if I screw up and pick a patent that, you know, really was the thing that was going to save the company? You know, that's a pretty big risk.
The next one seems like it might be the biggest critique that people had of the EcoPatent Commons, and that's that there's no tracking of usage of the patents once they've been contributed to the Commons.
Yeah, and I'll group together a couple of these critiques under the category of really no infrastructure.
Okay.
Right? There was no technology infrastructure. So the patents are listed by company. They're really just listed without any indication of what they are. It's not easy to use, right? A patent clearly is a legal right. It allows you to exploit this particular invention, but nobody creates a technology by just looking at patents up on a website. The website didn't tell the members who was looking at their patents, who was using them. And so the ongoing members, they contribute these patents at the beginning, but they never had an indication for who was using them, if anybody.
I saw you said there were no success stories. And so if anybody were motivated by a PR benefit, and we'll get to that probably in a little bit, there was no way to track whether they were benefiting from PR or even generating any PR out of it.
It's not, and even more than PR, there's no way to even tell if they're accomplishing their sustainability goal, right? So the
less cynical view of it.
The sustainability, right. I mean, so the sustainability group at the company wants to know, okay, did this work? You know, the patent department is telling me the cost of this was $15,000 that we spent to prosecute this patent, plus, you know, $5,000 of this guy's time to go find the patent. So what benefit came out of that? And the answer is we have no idea, because no one is tracking this. You know, it, from a corporate standpoint, it's very difficult to support membership in a program where you just have no idea what the benefit was that came out of it.
Another thing you mentioned was sort of a paradox, that the focus of the EcoPatent Commons in many ways is on the developing world. But in reality, the actual execution, it wasn't really effective in helping the developing world. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, it's a very nice intent. Some of the more successful patent commons in the world focus on medicines in the developing world, right? Neglected tropical diseases and so forth, where clearly there's a product like an HIV medication that is needed in the developing world, and that when you send it over there, there's an immediate result, right? You can see people, you know, fewer people are dying, something like this. With green technologies, the situation is much more complicated. It's not just a pill. What is a green technology? It's a wind turbine, right? It's a power plant. It's a water, you know, desalination system. They're big infrastructure projects. A lot of times, you need a lot more than a patent in order to make the thing happen, to implement the thing in the country, especially if it's a developing country, if they even need the thing to start with. So, for example, another one of the patents contributed also by IBM was for a less chemically intensive method of rinsing a semiconductor wafer during the semiconductor manufacturing process, which, fine, you know, that is probably better than previously, but how many countries have semiconductor fabs? Well, there's the US, Korea, Taiwan, you know, Japan, and China, you know, maybe Germany. It's not, there aren't any in Africa, as far as I'm aware. This is a developed country issue. not a developing world issue. And even, you know, I mean, the very thought that there would be any use in an African country for some of these extremely advanced technologies is doubtful. Then the third thing about the developing world that makes this odd is that patents are national. They only exist within national boundaries. You have a U.S. patent that gives you exclusive rights in the U.S. If you want exclusive rights in, say, Kenya, then you've got to file and get a Kenyan patent, which, you know, there are treaties that make that doable, but you still have to pay something for it. And the fact of the matter is that for most high-tech inventions, the companies, even big companies like IBM, will not be filing for patents in sub-Saharan Africa or really any developing countries because they don't need to, because there's no competitive manufacturer there and there's not even a market in those countries. And so there is no patent there. If there's no patent, that means that people in that country already have the right to go ahead and use a technology because there's nothing protecting it. But they don't. And why not? Well, because no one, this goes back to the technology transfer question. There's no one has provided training or infrastructure or technical assistance in doing whatever the thing is. And, you know, in previous work, I and others have argued that for green technology, it's about more than just patents. You know, a lot more of it depends on technical know-how, technical assistance, and so forth. And patents are a part of it, but maybe not even a huge part of it.
And then the last point, we don't have to really discuss it much unless you want to, because it seems pretty simple, but there's a declining commitment among these companies to really be pushing these environmental and sustainable initiatives, perhaps.
Yeah, this was an observation made by more than one of the people we interviewed. You know, and this is not something that we are able to quantitatively test, or we didn't. But certainly in the late 2000s, there was a big, you know, sort of the corporate or environmental sustainability was a big deal in corporate land. And that seems to have dropped off. Probably for some of the same reasons I've discussed, it's hard to measure any result or any success. And in fact, the corporate sustainability departments in many of these companies themselves had been disbanded or absorbed into something else. So undoubtedly that had some impact.
All right, now remember the disclaimer. We'll talk very briefly about the quantitative analysis here. So if you could just tell us what the top line kind of conclusions from the analysis were, that would be great.
Yeah, so my co-authors, as I said, extended their 2011, 2012 analysis up through 2018. And not surprisingly, found that the value of the patents, even after contribution, did not go up. The patents were not particularly valuable compared with a control group of similarly situated patents. These were not top green technologies. They were kind of the random things that large companies had just spun out as a result of doing R&D in a lot of different areas. And again, we're, at least from a patent value citation standpoint, not particularly valuable at the time they were contributed, and certainly did not become more valuable after they were contributed.
And you sent a survey to some of the inventors who had cited the patents as prior art that were involved in the EcoPatent Commons. And what did they have to say? Or I guess first, what were your questions to them, and what did they have to say?
Right, so we thought, and since we were looking at citations to the patents, I mean, often the way that you decide how valuable a patent is to look at how many other patents cite it. Patent examiners come up with the patents to cite, but the inventors do as well, the applicants also. So we thought we would ask some of these applicants in patents that you cited as prior art to an invention of yours. Did it matter that this was contributed to the Eco Patent Commons? And no one said that it was, that they even knew that the patent that they had cited was contributed to the Eco Patent Commons.
Sounds like a low chance that it affected their decision.
So it clearly did not affect their decision at all. And like, why not? Well, you know, they just found these patents by doing searches in the art category in which they were working on something. But, you know, if you're working on a new type of cardboard box and you come across this IBM patent on cardboard boxes, you'll cite it. Do you know anything about it? Or did you deliberately seek it out to use it? The answer was no, they did not.
All right, so through your study of the EcoPatent Commons, you interviewed a lot of the participants. You interviewed people who later cited inventions whose patents were contributed to the EcoPatent Commons, and you did an analysis of the citations. For all intents and purposes, it seems like the EcoPatent Commons was not successful at their stated goals of propagating these technologies and allowing for environmentally friendly technologies to be spread across the globe. So I noticed that you actually end your article a little bit more hopeful than that sort of analysis might have sounded. So what is your view on the EcoPatent Commons now? And do you think that patent commons and potentially a better version of this commons are possible?
I definitely do. I'm a scientist at heart, and I view this as an experiment. And not every experiment is successful, but that doesn't mean it was a worthless experiment, right? We learn things from our failures. And I think there are a number of valuable lessons that we can take away from the experience of the EcoPatent Commons, especially around the organizational features of it. You might have thought that you absolutely need a no-fee, free-to-join type of organization. Well, maybe not. You know, maybe some sort of modest fee or some organization that puts money behind the entity is necessary to make it work. You know, maybe there does have to be more of a concerted membership drive. Maybe, I think most importantly, there has to be a better deployment of whatever the technology resources are out into the world. Just posting lists of patents up on a website is not going to work. You need somebody actively to be going out there, finding uses for this technology, finding groups that might find it useful. And, you know, if that costs some money, then some money might have to be spent. But the payoff could eventually be much larger than what probably is a pretty modest investment. So I think we did learn some useful things here.
I think so. I think this is a great contribution to the discussion, and we're really proud to be publishing it in the Houston Law Review. And we're really grateful that you took the time today to join us and to discuss this article. So thank you very much, Professor Contreras.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association and from Vincent and Elkins. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email me at eic@houstonlawreview.org. Be sure to follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at HoustonLRev. That's Houston, L-R-E-V. Or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.